So the session's 60 minutes long, and we're going to ask you to respect the parameters of that, and we'll get started. Joanne has said, my husband and I didn't just wake up one sunny morning and say, hey, let's join a polygamist cult. Over time, a convergence of psychological and social factors ripened us for the picking. Insecurities played a part. So did classic cultish appeals. So did mainstream Mormonism, not just by laying a doctrinal foundation, but by training members to tolerate cognitive dissonance and through its own, albeit far less extreme, cultish tendencies. This presentation will examine those factors through her experiences and the work of psychologists such as Leon Felsinger. This is Joanne Hanks. She's the author of It's Not About Sex, My Ass, Confessions of an Ex-Mormon, Ex-Polygamist, Ex-Wife. Welcome.
Nice to be here. So, my name's Joanne Hanks, and as he said, I'm an ex-Mormon, ex-polygamist, ex-wife. Quite the title. My presentation today is This Is Your Brain on Polygamy, or on a cult, any cult. Besides polygamy, I'm going to discuss what cults are, why people join them, and what we can do to protect against them. But first, let me be clear about something. Here and in my book, I use sarcasm and humor. That's because the cult I was in was odd, but not threatening. I don't wish to make light of anyone who is in an extremely abusive cult. Those are out there. Okay, onward. Meet my family. This photo was in the 1996 edition of Sunstone. You can see my ex-husband and our three kids. That's me on the left. That's one of my sister wives. Jeff and I had been married for 7 years when she became his first plural wife. Later we added a third, and still later we tried to add a fourth. Maybe this will help a little. This was all with my full knowledge, permission, and even encouragement. My ex-husband Jeff and I were raised as mainstream Mormons. We were married in the temple. Then in our early 30s, we left the church and we joined the True and Living Church of Jesus Christ of Saints of the Last Days. God himself named the church, but he said it was okay to call it the TLC. Our prophet was James D. Harmston, Jim. He was a former real estate agent from Ogden, and he was a charmer. He could recite the scriptures like you just couldn't believe. Like all devout TLC members, we sold our home, and we moved to Manti, Utah's belly button. That's where God was gathering the elect. How did we know? God told Jim, the prophet. Jim already had a home in Manti, but I think that was just a coincidence. Soon, God told Jim that it was time for the TLC to get busy with polygamy. Dismayed as he must have been at the prospect of adding more women to his bed, many of them young and buxom, Jim gave in. What a self-sacrificing man of God. A schism followed soon after we began practicing polygamy. It started when a woman could hear her husband going at it upstairs with her new sister wife. Suddenly, she felt inspired to go up and get in the sack with them. I guess it was quite the party, because pretty soon, three in a bed was all the talk of the TLC. We called it three in a bed because we weren't sophisticated enough to say menage a trois. Some people thought three in a bed was great. Some people thought it was immoral. And some people thought it was immoral, but damn if it didn't sound like fun. Everyone prayed about it, and what a surprise, everyone thought that God was on their side. Finally, Jim got a revelation that God did not approve. For those who liked Threesome, this meant that Jim was a fallen prophet. So they broke off and started their own church. For the rest of us, having a splinter group felt kind of validating. We felt more like a real church. For those of us who remained in the church, God poured out revelations. Everyone received most remarkable answers to prayers. One man in our group prayed when he went shopping to know which cereal God wanted him to buy. And God always told him. I, for one, find that remarkable. I mean, do you really need God to tell you that Fruit Loops are great? Cereal is important, but what about socks? One of Harmson's wives, a teacher in our school, prayed each morning to know what socks God wanted her to wear. God never failed to tell her. You may find that strange, but what's more strange, we found out that she was a convicted child molester. Which meant that God, who had told a man what cereal to buy and a woman what socks to wear, failed to tell his prophet not to marry a convicted child molester and not to let her teach our school children. When it came to baptism for the dead, we one-upped the mainstream church. We didn't just baptize them. We held seances and talked with them. That way we could tell if they wanted baptism. They never turned us down. Of course, we didn't call them seances because seances are of the devil. We called them prayer sessions, so that made it okay. A lot of famous dead people were thrilled to hear from us and eager to be baptized. This included Abraham Lincoln, but I'll tell you, he had some splaining to do. We were peeved at him for not defending the early Mormons and for signing legislation banning polygamy. Of all the gall. But he apologized sweetly, and we just couldn't stay mad. Jim learned by revelation that many of us had lived prior lives as other people. This wasn't called reincarnation, mind you. Reincarnation, too, was of the devil. We called it the doctrine of multiple mortal probations, which made it okay. It turned out that quite a few of us had been famous. Jim himself found out that in a prior life, he had been none other than Joseph Smith. Before that, he was Martin Luther. Before that, the Holy Ghost. And before that, Jesus. Pretty soon, everybody was finding out they'd once been somebody famous. In our family, we learned that my husband, Jeff, had been Oliver Cowdery. My sister's wife found out that she had been Queen Elizabeth I. It was hard enough to get her to help around the house. Now that she was the Queen of England, all but impossible. All the cool, famous dead women were taken by the time I got in on it, so I had to settle for being Mary Elizabeth Rollins Leitner, one of Joseph Smith's many plural wives and not very remarkable. We knew that God was going to put a protective dome over Manti to spare us the wars, pestilences, and calamities of the last days, which we knew were near. Jesus was going to kick off his second coming in, surprise, Manti. He would bring fire and destruction and burn all the wicked as stubble. The wicked, of course, meant everyone who wasn't in the TLC. We even knew the day the second coming was going to happen. March 25th, 2000. And we were really excited. You see, after Jesus finished burning all the wicked, he was going to hand us the Manti Temple, which was rightfully ours. Then we sit down with Jesus inside the temple and the heavenly host for the Feast of the Bridegroom. I was put in charge of decorating the tables. Not that we had any tables. We figured when the time came, we'd just take them from the local Mormon churches. Since being dead and all, they couldn't stop us. This slide is a little misleading. Jesus wasn't going to bring the food. We had to provide it. So some of the women rented a refrigerated truck, drove up to the Costco in Orem, Utah, and bought tons of yummy, expensive food. And some of us baked. I baked hundreds of cookies. Surely Jesus and the heavenly host would enjoy cookies. You can't be a perfect being and not love cookies. The question arose as to how to bury all the bodies that were of the slain wicked people in Manti. So shortly before March 25th, God provided a backhoe. A fellow who just happened to own a couple of them joined our cult. We thought it was a miracle. I don't know if any of this sounds nutty to you. It sure does to me now that I'm back on the outside. No one who is in a cult thinks they're in a cult. Cults are what the other guys are in. And if you grow up in a setting where everyone thinks the same things you do and does the same things, those nutty things are by definition normal. But outside the cult, nutty beliefs and practices tend to stand out and look weird. So you have to wonder what kind of a nutcase raised in a mainstream society would look at something like the TLC and say, "That's for me. Sign me up." Take, for instance, this recovering nutcase standing in front of you. I grew up a mainstream Mormon. I graduated from BYU. I worked in the church office building. I married Jeff in the temple. I descended from the kind of pioneer stock that Mormons love to brag about. What on earth possessed me to not just leave all that, but to leave it for a weird polygamous cult? Ultimately, I'm responsible for my own decisions, and I really did come to believe the TLC. But my husband was the first to say, "Sign me up." He was a chiropractor, and while I'm sure there are some sane ones, his professional circle included some real loonies. One of them got Jeff involved in the survivalist and end of days movements that were popular at the time. They were fans of Bo Greitz. Some of you might remember that name. Soon Jeff was bringing me to secret meetings to learn the real meat of the gospel, the stuff that only the elect could handle. As for me, I caved. I went along with everything. My kids call me a lawn chair because I fold so easily under pressure. And it's true, I wasn't exactly the picture of independence and self-confidence. I was in my late 20s before I landed a husband, making me an old maid by Mormon standards. And I was terrified of losing Jeff. The thought of being abandoned by my husband scared me more than alienating my family and friends. Plus, and some of you women here today might identify with this, I was raised to obey men. Jeff was the smart one, the outgoing one, the breadwinner, and he was the boss, the priesthood holder. I was the awkward, 6-foot, gangly housewife. I felt damn lucky to have a man at all, and Jeff made it clear that he felt the same way. At this point, it'd probably be helpful to clarify how I'm using the word cult. I'll start with what a cult for today's purposes is not. First of all, a cult is not the occult. You can believe in the occult without belonging to a cult, and you can belong to a cult without believing in the occult. I suspect most of you here today already knew that, but it comes up fairly often, so I thought it'd be good to mention it. Some people call any small group a cult. That's pretty useless. By that definition, a sewing circle is a cult. Cultishness has nothing to do with group size. Cults come in all sizes, large and small. You'll also hear people talk about celebrities, products, or movements that have a so-called cult following. That's not what I'm talking about here either. If you're really into Apple products or wine tastings or Harley Davidson, or you'd do anything to meet Chris Pine, that might be called a cult following. which is fine, but you're not in a cult. This one may surprise you. What a group believes is not what makes it a cult. 25% of Americans believe that the sun circles the earth. That doesn't make them a cult. It makes them uninformed. Finally, whether you're dealing with a cult isn't always a yes or no question. So if we're not talking about the occult, or group size, or beliefs, or a yes or no question, what exactly makes a cult a cult? Here I'll defer to Dr. Stephen Novella. He's a clinical neurologist and a professor at Yale University School of Medicine and the president of the New England Skeptical Society. Novella points out that instead of thinking cult or not a cult, it's more useful to think in terms of a continuum. Some organizations are not at all cultish. Some, like the TLC, are way the heck cultish. And some fall somewhere in the middle. He also points out that it's not beliefs that make a cult, but certain behaviors, and how strictly those behaviors are practiced or enforced. Notice that's behaviors, plural. In other words, there's not just one continuum. In fact, there are many. But today I'm going to focus on six of the most common ones. First, let's deal with the elephant in the room. For most of you, these behaviors are going to sound somehow familiar. I didn't cherry-pick them to fit Mormonism. These behaviors are the ones that experts commonly use in defining cults. If you get too uncomfortable, remember that it's not just the behaviors, but how severely they're practiced or enforced. Your anal-retentive neighbor's Mormonism may be one dilly of a cult, while your other neighbor's Mormonism is more like a social club. You may or may not think Mormonism is a cult, but it has cultish aspects, and some of them helped me make me more vulnerable when the extreme came along. I'll be sharing a couple of examples, but to be fair, I'm also going to pick on other organizations, not just religions. So here's cultish behavior number one, strong central control. It's one thing to have a leader. Every group needs one. Businesses need a CEO. Teams need a coach. A tour needs a tour guide. But in a cult, leaders reach deeper and more broadly into your life. The authority may be vested in one person or in an exclusive group, and it dictates what you can and cannot do to an absurd level of detail and intrusion. A cult leader may presume to dictate your thinking, your diet, your attire, your friends, what is and isn't true knowledge, what to do on certain days, weeks, months, or even years, what you're allowed to do with your privates and with whom, gender roles, marriage decisions, and more. Finally, and importantly, strict obedience is expected and enforced by physical or psychological means. Cult members often mind one another's business and report under the guise of being their brother's keeper. Outside of cults, this is called tattling. Inside the cult, it's a way of keeping everybody in line. In the TLC, the slightest misstep was immediately reported to Jim. After we announced our intentions of leaving, various of Jim's wives would walk past our home, patrol-like, peering in our windows. Any members of the flock seen visiting us were reported and called on the carpet. So this touches on another control tactic: public shaming. step out of line and you'll be shunned, disfellowshipped, excommunicated, denounced, forced to wear a scarlet letter, or publicly embarrassed in some other way. 1 week after we quit, but before we moved away, Harmston cursed us from the pulpit. He told his horrified congregation that we would become the seed of Cain. Most of you get the implication, and you can see for yourselves just how well that so-called curse has worked. Now, all organizations have rules. The question is how many, how intrusive, and how they're enforced. You may wonder how people once on the outside could give up so much control. The answer is that cults get you to surrender one small step at a time. The first step is often to flatter you by telling you how special you are. This brings me to cultish behavior number two. You're the elect. There's something intoxicating about being one of the chosen, one of the few who really gets it. You see clearly and you pity all those blind ones out there. Meanwhile, your new elect friends welcome you, celebrate you, and very often love bomb you. Show a little interest and you'll get gifts, visits, meals, help in the kitchen or yard, you name it. Now, I'm not talking about neighborliness or friendliness, but an out-and-out attention blitz. It may not be deliberately subversive. These people are excited about what they have to offer. But it is intoxicating, and it's obligating. You don't want to let your new friends down. You start wanting to reward their efforts by becoming one of them. In the TLC, we love bombed with the best of intentions. One person turned the table on us. Jeff persuaded a stunningly beautiful woman who was already married, lived in the UK, to become his fourth wife. And I'll tell you, she was hot. Naturally, she was the toast of the community. Everyone showered her with attention, favors, and gifts. Oddly enough, lots of men received revelation that she was to not marry Jeff, but to marry them, which meant even more attention and gifts. Then she suddenly left. We later learned that she traveled the state visiting one polygamous group after another and accruing all the gifts she could carry home. Then she returned back to the UK for good. Because you're one of the elect, you understand what others do not. You know what the scriptures really say, what the government is really up to, what the real facts about medicine are, where the city of Enoch is, what 666 really means, and on and on. You see the world in a way that the less gifted cannot. You have the gift of sight, light, and knowledge. Did I mention that it's intoxicating? There's nothing quite so humbling as being better than everybody else. Being humbly better, however, does not come without cost. Over time, your newfound friends begin replacing your old ones, which leads me to cultish behavior number three, us versus them. The more you identify with your new friends, the less you identify with your old. In fact, you become a little suspicious of your family and former friends. And they have their doubts about you, which to you only seems to confirm that you should avoid them. There's something romantic about taking on the world. You're not just chosen, you're a warrior, a stalwart, a hero. You're standing up for truth and justice. As for those who just don't get it, whatever you do, don't listen to them. And for sure, don't let them influence you. The ultimate expression of us versus them is to isolate yourself. Some cults physically remove themselves from the rest of society so as not to be tainted. You recall that the TLC gathered to Manti. This got most of us away from our former acquaintances. We were surrounded by mainstream Mormons, but we kept to ourselves, and you can bet the Mormons avoided us. Short of relocating, cults have other ways of isolating themselves. They adopt peculiar attire, groom themselves in a certain way, develop their own colloquialisms, require circumcision, or impose food taboos. Besides building group cohesiveness, these distinctions can help members pick each other out from the crowd in ways that might be lost on outsiders. Perhaps more important, these behaviors can make outsiders seem unclean, less worthy, even disgusting. They are people to avoid, and certainly not to date, much less marry. Making outsiders seem disgusting or even scary is a good way to keep members from straying. The sad result is a feedback loop that prevents growth. No new thinking, no learning, no progress, no new information finds its way in. Cult members regurgitate and gorge on the same thing over and over. It fosters helplessness and interdependence so that members don't dream of venturing out. Which brings me to cultish behavior number 4. The cult is all you need. Venturing out is scary, but why should you? Everything you need is provided. Anyone can give you a few needful things, but the cult gives you everything. Everything you need to find success, happiness, and fulfillment. Seeking any of these things from the outside is a sign of weakness or lack of faith. If there's a question the cult can't answer, then the question isn't important. If you miss your family and former friends, you don't need them. It tells you who you are and how you fit in. And naturally, if you leave, you don't fit in. The cult even gives you your identity and feelings of self-worth. After all, if you're not happy, it's probably because you're not worthy. Now, as I said earlier, new recruits are brought to this point one small step at a time. Which brings me to cultish behavior number 5, secrets. Ever notice that proselytizers tend not to put their weirdest foot forward? Jehovah's Witnesses don't open with, "No more birthdays for the kids." Mormons don't open with, "We're here to take 10% of your pay. Would you like to know more?" Scientologists lead with a so-called personality test. And they don't just save the weird stuff for later, they sell it to you. In the TLC, we were open about polygamy, but we saved some things for later, too. For instance, we didn't start off with, "Wait till you try our garments, long sleeves, ankle length, and collars." Or, "Did you know that our prophet is really Jesus?" Cults justify withholding information with the milk before meat thing. New recruits can only tolerate milk. They'll be introduced to more difficult concepts when they're better able to tolerate meat. And for some reason, when an authority figure says, "Leave that stuff alone because you're not ready for it yet," people buy it. They become complicit in their own indoctrination. I challenge you to find any other area of knowledge where leaders do that. Math teachers would tell you that you need algebra before trigonometry, but they won't keep trigonometry a secret to protect your testimony of algebra. There are some things the rank and file are never privy to, such as inner workings, revenues, expenditures, high-level decision-making, personal lives of the leaders, historical details, and so on. When we talk about secrets, it's inevitable that temple ceremonies come to mind. But here's an example of secrets you wouldn't normally think of that have nothing to do with ceremonies. After finishing BYU in 1986, I went to work for the interior design department of the church's temple division. Once I had to hand carry a vase through the tunnel under the church headquarters on its way to sit on a pedestal in the Salt Lake Temple. The church paid $10,000 for that vase. That's about $22,000 in today's money. I was terrified that I'd drop it. And with the Denver Temple soon to open, I was told to order for the Celestial Room a genuine Lalique crystal chandelier. It came all the way from Paris. The church paid $200,000 for it, about $500,000 in today's dollars. Now, these were both secrets. I was told not to tell anyone that the church paid bought $200,000 chandeliers and bought $10,000 vases. And of course, to this day, my lips are sealed. Cultish behavior number 6. We weren't wrong. Sooner or later, a cult will mess up. A prediction won't come true. A leader will be compromised. New knowledge will invalidate a claim, or what have you. How leaders and believers handle that reveals something about cults in particular, and about how eager we humans are to cling to what we are motivated to believe. You may recall that the second coming was due on March 25th, 2000. We were ready. We prepared the feast. We put on temple clothes and gathered at the appointed time. We sang hymns, bore testimony, sang more hymns, bore more testimony for days. At last, we gathered in a prayer circle and told Jesus to come on down. By this time, I'd been having doubts. But they fled. I expected the ceiling to open right up for Jesus and the heavenly host to descend, burn all the wicked, and thank me for the cookies. It happened. Jesus came. Sorry I have to break it to you this way, but every one of you was burned at his coming. That being said, you may wonder why you're still here. That's where this fellow comes in, social psychologist Leon Festinger. He studied doomsday cults. He wanted to see how they handled things when predicted disasters didn't happen. He found that most of them emerged even more convinced than before. How do they do it? First, they assume they weren't wrong. It couldn't have been. So what happened? Casting about for an explanation that allows them not to have been wrong, cults tend to default to one or more of the following kinds of explanation. Popular explanation is that they had everything right except for the timing. Remember evangelist Harold Camping? He predicted that Jesus was coming on May 21st, 2011. There were even billboards warning us. When May 21st came and went with no signs of Jesus, Camping said he had just miscalculated. Jesus was coming on October 21st. Another explanation is that the prediction happened, but not in the way that was expected. Perhaps Jesus returned spiritually, not physically, or to heaven, not to earth. Among others, Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventists, have used this when Armageddon didn't start on the predicted dates. Some scholars argue that early Christians used it. The Messiah came, it's just that he freed us from sin instead of from Rome. And finally, they may say they weren't wrong and that we should thank them. Why? Because thanks to their preaching, prayers, steadfastness, God decided to give everyone a little more time to repent. So back to when Jesus came to Manti on March 25th, 2000. None of us noticed. How did we miss all the commotion? And why are all of you sitting here intact instead of in ashes? I did not know about Festinger's work then, and I'm sure Jim certainly didn't. But looking back, I now see that Jim resorted to a combination of all three explanations with a little dash of Star Trek. But that's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to give away everything in the book. So how cultish is a given group or organization? I say take those six traits, plot them on a continuum, and see what kind of overall score you come up with. So we've talked about what cults are, how they lure you in one step at a time, and how they hold you. You may think these things don't apply to you or to most people you know. I beg to differ. People surrender their will, thinking, money, time, relationships, and even health in varying degrees all the time. At the risk of making some of you mad, if I haven't already, here are some examples. I won't go as far to say that all of these are full-blown cults, but each has cultish attributes to some degree. They have a strong central authority figure. If you're not with them, you're against them. If you are with them, it's because you're special. Those who don't see it your way are blind or maybe even subversive or evil. Follow them and you'll be happy and fulfilled. And they're never wrong, or at least never wrong in any way that really matters. The fact is, there's a lot of baloney out there. And there's always a way to dress it up so that someone will buy it. That's because every human brain comes with an off switch. This is an actual x-ray showing the switch. Admit it, you, I, everybody has one of those switches. And sometimes we set it to off. Sometimes we let someone else set it to off for us. Notice that little hole right there? That hole baffled neurologists for years. Turns out, that's where you insert the baloney funnel. Now, a lot of the time when we set the switch to off, it's harmless. If you really think it'll help your team win, go ahead and yell at the TV. You're not hurting anything. It's another matter when switching to the off position leads us to surrender our time, money, or will. It was 15 years ago this month when we came to our senses and left the TLC. Since then, I've spent some time looking into what makes people into cult bait. I'm no mental health professional, but as a recovering cult victim, I was surprised to learn the many ways in which we unwittingly pressure ourselves and others to set the switch to off. So if you want to become cult bait, or to raise your kids to be cult bait, the next few minutes are for you. I'm going to give you 11 popular ways of setting the switch to off. Number one, learn to live with cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is what you experience when you come face to face with what contradicts what you think you know. I grew up knowing that the Earth was 6,000 years old and also 4.5 billion years old. That God always answers prayers, except not to worry when he doesn't answer mine. That a leader isn't wrong when just his opinion is wrong, and so on. So when the TLC's prophet made statements that didn't add up and predictions that didn't happen, I knew how to live with it. Number two, don't allow questions. There are lots of ways to disallow them. You don't need to know that right now is a good one. But what's really effective is the shaming thing. How dare you ask me that? Or, how dare you ask me that? There's also, I can't believe you don't trust me. When things in the TLC didn't add up, and there were a lot, I'd been trained not to ask about them. Number three, stress obedience and trust. It's no coincidence that this one follows don't allow questions. The real test isn't what you know, it's how willing you are to follow someone who knows what's best for you. Number four, don't trust your head. This is a big one. A cultish hallmark is to tell you to quit thinking. Science, evidence, testing, logic, that might be fine for heart surgery, but it's no way to go about learning anything important. Sure, emotions are fickle and they often lead you astray, but trust them. Number five, make excuses. Your psychic didn't get anything right? Electromagnetic waves must have interfered. No evidence of the Exodus? Pharaoh must have destroyed it all, which proves it happened. Just like no witnesses saying that 9/11 was an inside job proved that it was a cover-up. Let others tell you what happiness is. That way, when you're doing everything they tell you, you can say yes when someone asks you if you're happy. Number seven, allow no negative talk. The moment one of your kids says something bad about a playmate, a teacher, or a relative, jump right in and say, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. That way, everyone can learn to pretend that nothing is ever amiss or that anything doesn't add up. Number eight, worry about what others think. You don't want people to think you're a doubter, do you? You have to be an example. And you don't want people thinking you don't like them. You might not, but you don't want them thinking that. And even if you do disagree with them, you don't want them thinking that you do. Number nine, don't worry about what other people think. Let the world think you and your new friends are crazy. You have the truth. After all, people thought Galileo was crazy. If you really want to sound fair-minded, you can say something like this. If I didn't know what I know, and if I were in your shoes listening to me, I'd think I was crazy too. Never mind how revealing that statement is, or should be. Number 10, the only explanation you can think of is right. If you can't imagine any other way that that fortune cookie knew you were about to meet a stranger or go on a trip, it doesn't mean your imagination is limited. It means that the universe guided that fortune cookie into your hands. And number 11, don't do your homework. Research will just confuse you. And don't seek expert opinions, because experts are just shills for big pharma, big medicine, big government, big whatever. And don't learn how to spot common logical fallacies. What possible good could come from recognizing arguments that don't hold up? Just believe what you're told by the people who really know. I mean, who are you going to believe? Your pediatrician or somebody sincere and well-intentioned like Jenny McCarthy? So here you have it. If you ignore these techniques and if you fail to foist them on your kids, don't come whining to me. If you're never duped by even small things, much less suckered into a cult. Here's how I put it in my book. You didn't think you were going to get away without a book plug, did you? Here's the best protection from charlatans, manipulators, controllers, and opportunists that I can offer. Whenever you find your emotions pulling you toward believing the opposite of what the evidence says, overrule your emotions and trust the evidence. There's no better way to spare yourself the pain of needless, unfortunate decisions. Thank you. Well, here's my contact information. I'd love to hear from you. And links for buying my book. There's some downstairs in the bookstore area. And I'm ready for any questions if you have any. Okay.
We'll start here. Yeah, what happened to the truckload of food, and where are your kids today?
Good question. My kids are at home. My daughters are 23, 25. They're taking care of my elderly mother who moved in with us. And as far as the refrigerator truck, we thought about having a big feast after the real feast with the heavenly host didn't turn out. They didn't show. Well, they did, but we couldn't remember it. So, but then we decided that people weren't going to enjoy the feast because it was kind of a failure meal. So the truck was in our driveway. We invited all the church members to come over, and they just clamored and took all the food home. I think I got stuck with some vegetables.
You said that we left the cult. Was that you and who else?
My husband and I left the cult. Our children were grade school age when we left. And so we were on the same page when we left, and for about another 7 years, and then our marriage just kind of dissolved once we didn't have that religious fanaticism keeping us together, no religion at all keeping us together.
Did your sister wives leave at the same time?
The one sister wife that's in the book that you saw a picture of, she got revelation that she was supposed to marry Jim. So she married Jim and had a child with him, and she's still down in Manti, along with a lot of other of his family.
Let's go back here.
Yes, after hearing your presentation, I guess my response is, you're special.
Good answer.
She always did that. Let's go to Shane.
I'm just wondering what happened to the third sister wife.
The third sister wife, I explain more about it in the book.
Oh, okay.
It's pretty funny. She also left for another man. She wasn't very happy with the situation, so she found someone else for a while.
Joanne, where does guilt come into all this? When Jesus didn't show up, was there guilt placed on you? You weren't worthy, and I know that's one of the others.
Yeah, that's one of the excuses. But there was no way we were going to think we weren't worthy.
Okay.
We had to blame it on the rest of society or some of the people in our church. So it was mostly just major disappointment. I mean, we'd spent years telling family and friends that we were special and God was going to come to us. And when it didn't happen, we certainly didn't want to publicize that.
Lots and lots of parallels with just good old white bread slice traditional domestic violence situations where the victim is systematically dismantled by their abuser. Two-part question. One, did you experience a form of that kind of personhood dismantlement? And if you did, how did you rebuild?
I definitely did. But my marriage was such that had pretty much been going on from the start. And I think that's one of the reasons why I was so susceptible to this. Because I never measured up, you know, in any way.
And it was always about you, probably.
Yeah, the problems were my problem. Yeah, I was the one that needed to change and be fixed. So I think how I overcame that was time, people who are very, very supportive, and just getting rid of all those guilt trips, all the indoctrination of you've got to do this, you've got to do that, you're not worthy here, you're not worthy there. So just, you know, living life, enjoying it, not worrying about the past.
Next question is here.
First of all, I think you did just such an excellent job talking about the definition of a cult and cultish behaviors. It's something, I'm a cultural anthropologist, and it's hard for people to kind of wrap their heads around that sometimes. And you did that in a very broad way that I thought was very enlightening.
Thank you.
My question for you, however, is do you inherently equate the practice of polygamy with cult-like behavior?
I do, having experienced it. I don't think, in my opinion, that a woman could talk herself into this, or even a man, without outside indoctrination and pressure.
Okay.
I mean, it's not natural.
Was your cult leader an independent or a breakoff from another cult?
He was an independent.
And how large was the cult, and did they associate with other cults?
No, we didn't associate with other cults because we were the cult. Everybody else was a counterfeit. We had about 200 or 300 people, you know, children, families, at our biggest, I believe.
Was it hard to get out of it, or could you just leave?
It was very hard to get out of it. That's one of the cultish attributes, because... like I said, you know, if you leave, you're turning your back on God, you're going to be cursed, your life's going to be miserable, you're going to go become a son of perdition, you know, all these threats that are scary.
So it was a psychological part.
Yeah.
It was difficult, not
yeah. No, nobody had guns. Well, they did have guns. In fact, they had a lot of guns. But the one guy shot another guy's dog. That was about it.
Let's go right here.
Yes, what was your husband's initial, like, foundational attraction to the TLC? Like, when you guys decided, we're going to go do this, because... wasn't polygamy at that point that came
No,
later.
That's true. Polygamy came later. I think it was partly thinking we were finding something that nobody else had, you know, that we were special and we were perceiving this great knowledge and everybody around us wasn't. Also, he and I had, this is a big one for him, that movie... what's it called? Ephraim? About the pioneer guy, Ephraim Knowlton Hanks? Okay. Good. You don't know about it. Anyway, that was his great-great-great-grandfather. So he was proud of his pioneer ancestry, and Ephraim Knowlton Hanks had four wives. He was the Hancock Company? The famous one. Martin Hancock Company. And one of the, what was he called? Anyway, he was a famous pioneer polygamist. So polygamy was a big part of his ancestry, part of mine as well.
This woman here has been so patient.
Okay.
You want to skip?
Well, you answered one of the questions, but I was just wondering what happened to this wonderful ketchup that you had.
Yeah. What happened to my wonderful catch of a husband that I had. We stayed married for a full 20 years. Actually, the time in Manti, 7 years. It was about a 7-year split. First 7 years, we had 3 kids in 4 years. The next 7 years, we were Manti, and the next 7 years, we moved out of state and kind of fell away from each other. So yeah, we got divorced about 8 years ago, and he's remarried and living happily ever after, and I'm certainly better off.
What led you exactly, and your husband, to leave? I had a family member, Lisa's husband, who left a polygamous cult, and he thought he would go to hell, but he couldn't stand living there anymore. So what led you to your disaffection and enlightenment?
Well, see, when Jesus didn't show up, or showed up and we didn't remember, on March 25th, I go in depth in my book what happened. I'll give you a little
pretty good
secret. Jim came up with an explanation. My husband Jeff didn't really buy it. So one day, within a month or so, he was talking to one of Jim's wives, and he told her that he didn't really buy the explanation. Well, within 5 minutes, she was back at Jim's office telling him what Jeff had said. So that next week in church, a few days later, Jim got up and talked about what had happened, went through his explanation, and very pointedly, without naming Jeff's name, talked about those of you who don't believe this or, you know, not worthy, and, you know, just pretty much ripped on him in church. And Jeff sat there and was just kind of fuming. And afterward, he thought, nah, I'm not going to put up with this. That was the first time Jim had really criticized Jeff or give him a bad time. And so he just started thinking, you know, this isn't what we thought it was. Mostly he didn't want our kids to grow up and end up marrying in a polygamist way.
Justice Scalia has said that if we now have a legalized gay marriage, it's automatic legally that we should be able to, that it will lead to polygamous marriage being legal. What would you tell Justice Scalia?
Well, I'm not sure I like anything about Justice Scalia, to be honest with you. Well, the point about polygamy, in my opinion, is that it's not needed in today's society. I don't know that it ever was. It's a form of indoctrination on the men, and then especially the women. But if somebody chooses to do it, they're not hurting anyone. We were okay because we didn't claim it legally, and there was no sexual abuse. There was mental abuse, but there's mental abuse in lots of marriages and in lots of situations. So as far as it being an alternative marriage type of thing, I'm pretty willing to say that people can do what they want as long as they're not taking away other people's rights.
Can we go to this one right here?
I have three short questions. The first one is Harmson, a former Mormon.
What was that?
Is Harmson a former Mormon?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And number two, the information in your presentation, is any of that accurate?
Is any of that what?
In your book.
Yes. Yes.
Most of it?
Yeah, most
and
of it.
Number three, what were your financial obligations as membership in this
book? Oh, good question. Mm-hmm. Well, of course there was tithing. And then after a while we got into the law of consecration. So we went and talked to our bishop in the TLC. We had a little bishop. And we pretty much listed all of our talents and all of our possessions and said they belong to the church. We even had signs put up in our yards because we always had to show off. We always had to proselytize. So we had signs put up in our yards that said this is consecrated property of the True and Living Church, blah, blah, blah. And legally, it didn't hold. We didn't do anything legally. The marriages were not legal. The the financial things weren't legal. So it was just all pretend.
We've run out of time. I'm sorry. If there's more questions, they'll have to wait until later. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.